Welcome to The Ether. Today is Thursday, April 21st, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Orbital Command. Have you heard of TDX? Listen, Orbital Command is putting together the Terra DAP Expo on June 9th and 10th in Austin, Texas. Not Boston. I know, that's what I thought. Austin. Austin, Texas. Come get doxxed IRL and share merriments with all of your favorite fellow lunatics and lunatics. For more information, go to terradapexpo.com or hit the menu item on the site right here on terraspaces.org. And as always, be sure to check out Orbital Command online at orbitalcommand.io. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, the Anchor AMA with Risk Harbor. Let's take a listen.
Hey, what's up, Nina? What's up, Max? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. Yeah, I can hear you.
Awesome. Just waiting for some people to join in here, and then we will get started soon.
Wonderful.
Hey, everybody. Great to be here.
Hey, Nate. How are you doing?
Doing well. Doing well. It's been a bit since we've had a Risk Harbor Ozone, so this will be great. And we're going to twist it up a little bit, too, because we've got some Wharton Business School people, so this is going to be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you guys know... If the Wharton people are in here already,
let me double check.
If you guys are in here, by the way, just feel free to request to speak, and then I'll bring you guys up.
Let me double check. I think I got the Twitter handle.
Hello, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Hi, yeah. I'm Jenny from Wharton.
Awesome. Great to have you here.
Hey, thank you so much.
Welcome, welcome. We got Sam in here as well. Sam, can you hear us?
Hey, hey. Nice to be here. Love talking about insurance.
Assurance. We're going to assurance.
Do we have anyone else joining in, Nate, or is this everyone?
I think this would be good. Yeah, I think we've got completely everyone on, and so probably can go ahead and get it kicked off. Max, maybe we'll hand it to you. Let us know what you guys have been working on, and then we'll kind of jump into what we have to cover tonight and turn it over for questions towards the end as we normally do.
Yeah, great. We have a lot of updates, but I'll just start with a bit of an overview of what DeFi insurance is and why it's needed and kind of an overview of the space. So I think the first thing is we see these huge hacks happening where people are just losing millions and millions of dollars. And that's what the demand is for, right? The $80 million hack recently on the stablecoin protocol. 6 months ago, $120 million on Cream, the wormhole hack, $330 million. You know, these numbers are huge, and it means there's a lot of demand for insurance. And with Anchor being the largest lending protocol by TVL, you know, they have the most demand for insurance. And that's really what Risk Harbor Ozone is trying to provide, is filling that gap of capacity. There wasn't enough capacity of insurance to meet the demand. And the exciting news I have to share now is that we've upped the capacity thanks to funds from the Terra Community Fund. Now there's 200 million of capacity on Risk Harbor Ozone, and already 45 million of that is being utilized in just 1 week. So we're really excited to share that.
Yeah, that's super exciting. That just really shows you the sheer demand there is out there to see that ramp up that quick. We might have to bootstrap more than a billion, right?
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. But I think, I mean, we have some other plans that are going to help us use that $1 billion more effectively coming up in our V2. And that's going to allow us to use the $1 billion to underwrite on many protocols simultaneously. So it's not just 1 billion of capacity, it's more like 10 billion or, you know, however many protocols we can integrate with and people want to buy protection with. So we think that $1 billion is going to go a long way, longer than just, you know, $1 billion. Obviously, primary focus is Anchor right now, but eventually we hope to integrate with a lot of other protocols on Terra and elsewhere as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, getting towards capital efficiency. And I'm sure we can dive in later to some of these V2 issues for sure, because that sounds exciting to hop into that later.
Max, one question, you know, related to this refresh of 200 million in capacity. For those users who are in here who might not have known that this refresh occurred or might not know how to get their hands on some of this protection on their AUST deposits, how would a user actually go through that process?
Yeah, so if you go to riskharbor.com and you click, there's two different buttons you can click. One is for the Ethereum virtual machine EVM chains, and one of them is for Terra. Click on the Ozone symbol, and that'll take you to the Terra part of the website. And on there, there is an order box where you can kind of fill in the amount of protection you want, pay with whatever currency you want for gas, and you'll basically get a token, which is the Risk Harbor AUST, which is your protection token for however much you bought. And the price right now for the just over 2 months that the vault is live is just, it's point four. It's 0.4%. So if you're insuring 100 UST, you're gonna pay 40 cents.
Gotcha. And then that protects you against, you know, what exactly is that protecting against for those people who might not know in here how that protection works from Ozone?
Right. So let me just give a little bit of background on the way that other protocols work and why we're different at Risk Harbor. So the way that the standard DeFi insurance model kind of started with Nexus was they had this big DAO with a bunch of people holding tokens, and the people who held the tokens were the people who decided whether claims were valid or not. And so there's a few problems with that. One of them was it took forever for a claim to get approved. The other one was that often the people who held the governance tokens, for example, the NXM token, were heavily involved in the protocol as underwriters. So if they were to approve a claim, a valid claim, then they would be paying out of their own pocket. So there was a big conflict of interest there, and it took a while. And what we said at Risk Harbor was, if this data is all on chain, whether or not the protocol is in default, why don't we just check it on chain and pay out on chain if it is in default? So that's what we did. We built out smart contracts that detect default, and they automatically detect whether the AUST, which is your claim token that you get from Anchor, redeems to the appropriate amount of UST. And if it doesn't, then the payout is automatic, and it can happen in as little as two blocks, which is, you know, very short time on Terra. When compared to the status quo, the traditional version where it takes forever to pay out and you're not even sure if it's going to pay out. For example, today, just today, there was a denial of a claim on some people who had an insurance claim on Neutrino, the stablecoin that just depegged recently. And I think they had their claim denied through like some dispute system. And it's just like, what you really want in insurance is to take the risk away, not to add more risk that your claim isn't going to get paid. So that's kind of, so, and then to answer your question of what are the risks of a depositor in Anchor that we are protecting against, because it's just a default detector, it's kind of agnostic of what happens. Anything that makes that AUST not redeemable for UST is insured. So some examples of what could happen, not that these will happen, but these are kind of the unlikely events that we're insuring against. There's these things called deflationary spirals. where the protocol kind of takes on bad debt and that kind of spirals out of control. It's similar to a bank run as well. And then there's also obviously the hack kind of thing that could just happen. Maybe the protocol gets upgraded and something wasn't specified right in the security, and the funds are lost that way. So both of those are protected by our model.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Well, thanks for providing that overview. I think that's super helpful for people to better understand that. Nate, did you want to hop in with something?
Yeah, that's just why this model is like a really great model, right? You're taking out an overhead cost, right? And not only are you taking over that overhead cost, you're taking out kind of that, it's not quite adverse selection, but you're taking out that disproportionate subjective bias that exists there, where the actual underwriters, it's in their best interest to not actually approve these claims. So you're actually taking out two highly inefficient things that can be completely automated on blockchain. And I think that's why this is a really great model.
Yeah, and one more thing to add on that is until last week, this was kind of theoretical. We'd back tested a ton, but we hadn't actually seen a hack on an insurance pool that was live. That was until last week, when the Ichi 1UNI token, which was a stablecoin depegged, and our automated default detector, which I actually wrote that contract to integrate with the Uniswap B3 Oracle, that detected the hack automatically and paid out. So that's kind of exciting for us. I mean, it was about $200,000 liability, so that's not great, obviously. But we're happy to see that the system was actually stress testing live, and it worked nominally.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. So how many users, do you know how many user wallets were refunded there?
I don't know that number off the top of my head. I think somebody from the team may give that to me.
I was just wondering if it was just like a few wallets or just a big wallet, just because the more wallets that were refunded, the better that stress test would seem, right?
Yeah, in some ways, although it's the same exact code getting checked, right? So okay, so there's around 15 policyholders that got paid up.
Right on.
Nice. So I was curious, Max, related to, and maybe just, you know, a few more questions on the Ozone refresh, and then I'd also like to get Jay involved here from Wharton as well, getting your thoughts on risk as well as DeFi insurance. But when it comes to the usage, you know, you said it's somewhere around like 35 or 45 million, I think you said, over this first week with the 200 million refresh that you've had. You know, as you guys have kind of looked at the data, or I guess first question is, did you look at the data? But if you have, what have you seen in terms of usage statistics? Like, is this a bunch of smaller accounts that are coming in and buying up some of that insurance? Or are we seeing some larger institutional accounts that are taking advantage of this new kind of risk mitigation mechanism?
Yeah, so I think so far, what we've seen is kind of smaller and medium-sized purchases. We have larger purchasers lined up, including the Arrington Anchor Fund and Alice, who are going to be huge purchasers. And one of the things we like that integration with Alice, because it means we can kind of make sure that some of the insurance is reserved for the little guy through Alice. But those bigger purchasers are lined up. They just take a little bit of time to enter, and they have to get all their legal stuff in order. So we're just waiting on those for now. And so we also we wanted them to hold back a little bit to make sure that retail got in, and clearly there was a lot of demand from those low and medium sized purchasers.
Awesome. Jay, do you have any thoughts on that? Any questions so far?
I had a follow-up question, if you don't mind. So you guys protect against a lot of risks of protocols. Would you mind talking about maybe some of the risks of using, Risk Harbor? If there are any, or what those might be, and what kind of tail risk scenarios where your claim doesn't get paid out because there's not money there, or who knows what would happen.
Yeah, so I think there's not a whole lot of risk in the current version that's deployed because there's no leverage. So there's always going to be smart contract risk, no matter what. No matter how sophisticated the team is, you know, there's always going to be those risks. But I think it's pretty low if you're a protection purchaser, because for that to be a real problem, what has to happen is that Anchor gets hacked and Risk Harbor Ozone gets hacked during the term, right? Which, so that's pretty unlikely. That smart contract protection is usually like a pretty independent event. And right now we have this over-collateralized model where there's no leverage. So it's not going to happen that you can purchase protection and then some other protocol gets hacked and the funds that were supposed to be covering your liability are now being used to cover somebody else's. As we move towards a leverage model, that's going to be something that we have to do, and that's going to be an additional risk for the policyholders. But that is going to be the trade-off for increased capital efficiency, and it's one of the things that the insurance model kind of dictates has to happen eventually.
Makes sense. Hi, it's Jenny. Sorry, I thought I was on mute just now. I think it's very interesting and excited to know that there has been increasing capacity for risk cover, and it is encouraging purchasers from especially smaller and medium-sized participants to join into this community as well. I think, as Max just mentioned, I think another thing that is very interesting in this model is the risk pooling, the multi-pool walls, which actually increase the capital efficiency of risk cover to a great extent. So I'm actually very curious, like, how the risk of various pools under each wall are like evaluated to ensure the safety on each coverage pool. As we know that, I think the thing, the factors we are trying to evaluate here is like how correlated for each individual pool under the vault is like compared to each other. Like Max or the team, is it possible to elaborate more on this point?
Yeah, so this is something that I've been working on, and I think it's an extremely important part of what we do. And in fact, in our AMM, there's kind of a spot to put information that we gather through our models about the correlation between protocols. And that, you know, makes it so that if two protocols like Aave and Compound, which are two lending protocols on mainnet, are highly correlated in their failure risk, which they are because they have many of the same assets, then when we sell protection on Compound, we're going to increase the price not only on Compound, but on Aave as well because of that correlated risk, because we don't want to take on too many liabilities that we're going to pay out at the same time. So that's something we've been thinking about a lot because we have that parameterization that we need to actually fill in. So we have our own risk engine that we run, and that's proprietary, but I can say a little bit about how it works and about what we're also thinking about doing in the future. So one of the things is the price of the protection that we offer has a sort of no arbitrage condition with the rate. So if you buy protection and deposit, then what you have is kind of a risk-free yield. And so regardless of how risky the protocol is, as long as you're protected, the yield minus the premium should be around the same. So that's one of the ways that we can use the market and where the capital is flowing to kind of price the risk. And then we can think about the structure of the protocols themselves and how they're related. For example, like on Ethereum mainnet, you have a protocol like Element, which builds on top of the Curve yield, right? So clearly, if Curve fails, then the Element pool is going to fail. On Avalanche, which where we just launched our vault, there's a protocol called Yeti, which is kind of a stable coin for leverage, and they let you deposit Trader Joe lending tokens. And so what we found in our deep dive into that is if something happens on Trader Joe, we know that there's also going to be a problem on Yeti. And so we can put that into our models and price it that way. So then kind of my wish list, and I've actually been talking to some people, including recently talked to a professor at Harvard who used to do a lot of kind of correlated failure risk at the IMF. And basically, we want to do similar kind of things where we're really simulating, really stress testing in a simulated environment. What happens to this whole DeFi ecosystem if something goes wrong? And of course, that's going to feed back into pricing more accurately, allowing us to have more capital efficiency and ultimately a better experience for the end user.
That's really fascinating. Kind of a more technical question on that. Obviously, you've got formulas that are calculating this. What's your solvency capital requirements kind of look like in that? Like, what standard deviation are you setting those risk parameters to? And kind of how are you calculating, like, let's say a 2 or 3 sigma event on these protocols or these interlinked correlations? Are they balancing each other out?
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to find. So just to give an example for everybody, because not everybody may be like familiar with what the kind of exercise is here. In TradFi, there's a great example of people who sell annuities, which pay out every year, and they also have life insurance on their book. So that when an event like COVID comes along and causes a bunch of old people to die early, all of a sudden the annuities, which they don't have to pay out because people died early, are worth more, even though they had a bunch of life insurance payouts, their book is fine, right? So the question is, can we find similar types of things in DeFi so that we can hedge in the same way as they're doing with that life insurance annuity spread? And by the way, this is why kind of you see the ads on TV about people trying to buy annuities, because usually the life insurance demand is kind of higher than the annuity demand. So they try to buy the annuities from people who already have them. Anyway, yeah, it's a hard question in DeFi, especially since the spaces are nascent right now and there's kind of a lot of stuff coming up. One thing you can do if you're trying to manage a book like this is to short the underlying token. We're not doing that right now because we're kind of funded by the Terra Community Fund, but that's one way to manage this, is because you just kind of short the underlying token a little bit with a highly leveraged position on, say, a perp or something. And then if a hack goes down, then the token price is going to go down. And so you can kind of ensure that way. I mean, this is actually one way that sometimes people who sell credit default swaps in trad markets will try to hedge their risk on a corporate bond, is by shorting the stock with a very out of the money put option on the stock as a kind of insurance that hedges their position.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I was actually going to go there, but you went there before I did. Because everything's so heavily correlated right now, right? It's really hard to find some kind of diversified asset. So really the only thing you can really bet on in this point is volatility, right? So if you can actually be long volatility, which is exactly like what you just said, you know, selling or buying a put option is long volatility, or selling a call option is long volatility in a way. So I think that's a really interesting way to create diversity. And we're starting to see a lot more DeFi options platforms pop up. As you know, we've got Sigma coming to Terra. Have you guys been in touch with them as possibly using a DeFi option vault as a risk mitigation strategy, you know, like a 10 delta put, you know, DeFi option vault kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't think we've been in touch yet, but I think it's something that we're definitely looking into exploring. Usually the calls are coming first, because the covered call strategy is kind of easier to run than the put strategy, for the same reason that we have this trouble, you know, finding liquidity in for insurance, is the short, the very out of the money puts are kind of hard space to be in because they're very correlated with kind of everything else going wrong. So they're very hard to hedge. So there's a fundamental limitation there, which is when those very out of the money puts, and by that I mean like something that pays out if the price of the token goes way, way down, it's hard to find liquidity for that because the state of the world where those pay out is very, very bad. So they're going to have the same problem that we have in trying to fund those very out of the money puts that we would want.
You need to find an OTC counterparty to that trade, right? The DeFi space just isn't quite sophisticated enough, but put a price on it, any OTC party is going to offer it to you. Is that really the fair price though, right? It'll be interesting to see, because you can do on the call side, you're going to have, in my opinion, what's called an inverse volatility skew, and just because you've got so much demand to the upside because it always goes up, so you're probably going to get more premium on the calls anyway, so that makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that like this is really related to is why is the price, why was the price so high on Nexus for anchor protection before we came in and offer this? It's like, because it's just really hard to find underwriting capital that can hedge itself appropriately to manage these risks, right? And that's why there was. It's not that the actual probability of anchor failure was, 4% or whatever Nexus was charging. But the problem was actually a liquidity constraint on kind of insurance in that state of the world where kind of anchor goes down is just a hard place to find, which is why it's so great that the Terra Community Fund was able to step up and provide those underwriting funds. Because otherwise there was a kind of unmet demand at a fair premium that wasn't being filled because of that difficulty in finding underwriting capital.
Yeah, that's a fair point. It'll be interesting to see if, with a 0.4% premium, that it starts forcing other protocols to be more capital efficient and changing their models to compete. I'm actually really interested to see what happens there on that front. And so on that note, I just kind of go back to my other question real quick, just because I'm a math nerd. What is the standard deviation that you guys are calculating at to determine that that's a 0.4% premium there that people are paying for protection?
Yeah, so I mean, for the right now on Anchor, we're actually just basically pricing at there's no like standard deviation there because there's no correlated risk, right? It's just kind of like we should price at an actuarially fair rate that the market is willing to bear. And it's like very clear from the demand so far and the fact that there's, 60 million on Nexus at 3.6%, that this is a fair rate in the market that kind of matches what it's not necessarily representing the actual risk of Ozone, right? Like we're at 2% a year. It's not saying that anchor that 2% to fail in a year. It just means the kind of willingness to pay, which is the actuarially fair price, the actual probability that it fails, plus some risk premium. Like people are willing to pay a lot to insure in that bad state of the world.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Yeah, it's
and I think hard. I mean. Yeah, and the reason we're getting funding and subsidization from the Terra Community Fund to provide this, right? So it's a public good that we want to provide at a fair rate to the community, not price gouge them.
Right on. Seffy, why don't you hop on here? You got a question patiently waiting.
So as kind of an insurance newbie here, so the pool of money that sort of Risk Harbor looks after in the insurance industry, is it like a norm that you make some portion of the money like productive in some way, or does that just simply add additional risk on top of that? Like, is there a concept of like increasing the size of the insurance pool through any other external mechanisms besides the premiums that people bring in.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely what insurance funds do. They're huge premium sellers, meaning they're selling a lot of premium and options, and as Max mentioned, annuities and other things like that. Yeah, and probably Max can allude more to like that if he wants to.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's absolutely something that insurance companies look to do when they have kind of their capital on hand, right? They look to put it in assets that they can expect to be liquid enough and safe enough to pay out if they need to pay out a claim, right? So, right, I think maybe the example of the annuities and life insurance is a little bit different, but one thing we are doing right now on Avalanche is having people underwrite with Three Curve, which is a yield-bearing token. So they're getting, we think that's a really safe battle-tested protocol that's pretty uncorrelated with the other stuff that's going on. And so because, and it's also very liquid. So the fact that, you know, we can put that in some place and earn an additional yield on that is great. On the Ozone side, though, if we were to kind of earn yield on the UST, other than through providing protection, it would be dilutive to the yield, right? Which is not what the community funds are for. They're there to provide the underwriting capital. So that's not something we're looking to do right now with the kind of Terra community funds. We're just using those as a backstop.
Just put it into Anchor, Max.
yeah.
So rehypothecation to the Max.
I think my connection is going out. Sorry, guys.
No worries. So yeah, kind of on that note, I guess one last thing I would want to bring up is, like, I think we wanted to get into the peg protection. I think that maybe just kind of kick gears to that.
I think we should talk about V2 as well. I think that's something that would be useful for people that are interested in learning about what you guys have to come.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that. And also, guys, I just pinned a tweet from Risk Harbor where the people that might be new to all these can go and see a little bit more of these and the step-by-step if you guys want to participate in all this.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for that. So let's start with peg protection and where we're at right now with that. So because we have the UST funds, it's very hard to offer UST peg protection. It would be just as ridiculous as kind of depositing the funds that we're using to insure Anchor into Anchor, right? It would be incestuous. So we have to basically have some way of having an asset which can cover the losses of a UST DPEG if it DPEGs, otherwise the insurance is kind of meaningless. So that's a challenge. One thing we, Doe recognizes this, and he's doing his own stuff to shore up the peg. And we actually advised on the creation of the Bitcoin Stability Fund. So we advise on some specifics, circuit breakers and stuff on that mechanism, because, you know, we think that's kind of a great mechanism for the UST peg for now. We are working on some sophisticated financial engineering. I can't share any details of it right now to see what we can do about the UST peg. It is something we covered initially when we first started offering Anchor protection with USDC as our underwriting asset. And it was very popular. But as of now, it looks like there is sufficient demand for Anchor protection even without the UST DPEG protection, because of all these other systems that are being put in place to shore up the UST peg, including the Bitcoin fund. So, okay, yeah. Any questions on that before I move on to V2?
Well, you can kind of just go over to FTX and short UST, right? Like, you can provide your own protection with the perpetual on UST.
Right, but that would be, that would actually be downward pressure, and it would contribute to instability in UST, right? If we are holding a big short position on UST.
Oh, no, I'm saying individuals. Like, what's your competitive? I'm not actually sure what the UST futures trading at. I think it's projecting like a few percent peg within like 2 years or something. I'd have to double check on that. But I was curious, like, what is your rate compared to what like the FTX futures cost? Essentially, it's the same insurance mechanism, right? You're short the FTX UST future. I was wondering if your rate is kind of targeting that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we were doing with our rate is we think that the kind of UST is pretty safe, and so we're just kind of trying to price what the market will bear, and it's bundled, so it's hard to disentangle what our UST peg protection is with. And this is, so just to clarify, we have our Ozone vault, which is on Terra, and we have our mainnet vault on Ethereum. And the Ethereum vault currently sells anchor protection bundled with UST DPEG protection, but the Ozone side doesn't do that. And the reason the Ethereum vault can do that is because it's underwritten in USDC, which can be used to pay out a UST DPEG event, whereas if we're paying out a UST DPEG event in UST, we're, you know, doing nothing. So there's not very much capacity available on that pool, and also this it's bundled, so it's hard to disentangle which part of it is the anchor protection, which part of it is the UST protection. But yeah, I mean, people can go in and make their own, you know, hedges on through other financial instruments for the UST peg, certainly. That's a good point.
Cool. I'll put Steffi in, and then we'll go Max, to V2.
Yeah, just a very brief question. In your mind, like, the proportionality and as far as the size of the BTC reserve, like, what kind of probability reduction do you sort of assign that in terms of peg maintenance? Do you think the cost at this point to force a DPEG is sufficiently low enough to make it nearly irrelevant? Or like, where do you see that? Like, how much did this de-risk a DPEG problem, which is obviously the big question everyone always wants to ask about this?
I actually have a quick question on the stablecoin peg protection. I think it's very excited that RiskCover is going to provide protection on UST depegging rig. I can definitely see there's a growing demand and like for it. Just given the mechanisms you just mentioned, I'm trying to see like how is the default ratio in the smart contract usually decided for like both hacks and DPEG risk, and how like will there be any special considerations when it comes to the DPEGging risk, given like the specialty in this risk specifically?
Yeah, so can you just repeat your question, Cephal, and I'll answer that one, and then I'll answer your question.
No, well, just
yeah,
like
I think
Bitcoin
the key
reserve,
question I'm trying to ask is like, how is the default ratio in the smart contract you already decided for like when it comes to the depegging risk, and is there any special considerations just because like with the old backstop for the UST depeg?
Yeah, okay. So the so there's two we have this default ratio here, which is kind of how much does the redeemability of the asset have to fall below 1-to-1 for us to consider it a payout event, right?
Yeah.
And so there's two different default ratios. One of them is going to be on the AUST to UST ratio. And then for our Avalanche and ETH vaults where we're selling the UST DPEG protection as well, we have another ratio that's for the UST DPEG. And I believe off the top of my head, it's 95%.
Yeah.
For both. And the reason, I think the threshold for the Bitcoin fund is 97%. So we want to give that a chance to kick in before ours kicks in.
That makes
we want to let the system level stuff kick in before we... And this is also what we did with the Ichi pool, which paid out automatically based on that default detector last week, which was a stablecoin DPEG situation. So.
Okay, got it. And really good to see, like, there's a real case, at least as a stress testing to the whole system. Yeah.
Cool. Did you want to repeat your question, Cephal? Sorry.
No, that was exactly my question. She just, like, stated it better than I did.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and one thing I want to emphasize before we move on from this DPEG topic is, you know, we know how to do DPEG protection, and we're working on some stuff behind the scenes that we're going to be launching for Ozone V2. I can't share any specific details about it, but we obviously know how to do it. There is a slight challenge with the fact that we have UST right now underwriting, and so it's just a bunch of financial engineering to make sure that we have the assets to pay out if we do need to pay that out.
Cool, really exciting. So let's kind of
Nate, we have gears. We have a couple questions here coming in from the audience. So do we want to start taking some questions from them now?
Should we do V2 and then do that maybe?
Sure.
Yeah. I'll just be quick on V2. I think I've said some of the key points in it already, but the main change is we're moving from this over collateralized solution to one which is leveraged, and that allows us to use the $1 billion to protect more than one protocol at the same time. So we have kind of two main changes. One of them is the change from a one pool vault to many pool vault. Then the second change is we have to adjust our pricing dynamically based on market conditions. And I gave the example earlier. If you have two hypercorrelated protocols like Aave and Compound, and you're selling protection on both of them, somebody goes and buys a bunch of protection on Compound, then I better go and increase my price on Aave as well to maintain my solvency. And I think probably I'll just preempt this question about the kind of, now that we're talking about correlated risk, we can talk about, you know, the risk management standards and how we go about that. So instead of saying that we're willing to tolerate a certain amount of, you know, failure risk, we actually let the pricing kind of disincentivize people from taking on that kind of the kind of positions that would cause the vault to be in kind of default more often. And so as you start to try and purchase more and more protection on a certain pool, maybe which is correlated with other pools that are already heavily weighted, the price is going to become prohibitively expensive so that you can't do that. And, you know, if you're willing to pay that additional premium, the risk premium that the vault is going to start charging you, then that's okay. But you also have to be aware that, you know, your protection may not be worth the full amount if everything that's correlated fails at the same time. So I think there's kind of natural incentives for the people buying protection to make sure that the protection that they're buying isn't causing the protocol to take on a bunch of liability that may potentially come due at the same time. And that's kind of what the automated market maker does. It says, it has two aspects, and one of them is kind of the risk premium that increases as it takes on more risk. And so if it is heavily leveraged, then the premium prices for more protection purchases are going to be very expensive to prevent people from entering positions that would cause the protocol to potentially become insolvent.
Very interesting. Let's start, Nina, if you want, we can start taking some of these questions. I'm going to add up first here JD, who's been waiting patiently.
Yeah, he was the first one.
JD, do you have a question?
He's still connecting.
JD, can you hear us?
I can see from here he's still connecting. Maybe we can pass to Tokema and then come back to him.
Yeah, let's go to the next one here with TR. Tokamak, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Hey, thanks for letting me ask a question. I got on a little late, so I'm not sure if it was covered earlier. And it's specific to Anchor, so on topic. but just don't want to deviate too far. And you guys can just let me know. But it's in regards to liquidation. So when you have collateral that's blended across, say, B Luna, B ETH, AVAX, and B Atom, there's no indication. Like if you just have single asset allocation, like a B Luna, you can see your liquidation threshold, see your liquidation price. But there is none when you kind of have the blended. And I was just wondering, how is that determined when a liquidation event occurs? And say you go into like the Terra Station wallet, and then you can see in the history, and you can see maybe if there's a liquidation event. I'm just wondering, you know, if you could shed some light on how that's blended, how the liquidations might be blended, and if that's going to show up in any type of detail, like in, say, the Terra Station wallet history. And you can let me know if this is kind of on topic or a little too specific.
Oh, we can grab it real quick. It's not insurance related, but it's fine. I mean, your on-chain data is just simply going to show you what the transaction happened, like where you were liquidated at. And so you can then see, you know, where you were liquidated at. It does get a lot more complicated when you have, you know, if you're, you've got multiple collateral types, they're gonna be liquidated in proportion of what they need to be liquidated at based on the price feeds to bring you back into the blended safe level.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the way that it works when you have multiple collateral is it's not really adjusted by the fact that you're diversified. Just you have kind of a collateral factor for your AVAX and a collateral factor for your Luna, and you kind of multiplies them linearly and sums them up, and that's the check, right? So there's no kind of correlation matrix in there or anything. It's just kind of a direct sum.
Correct, exactly.
Hey guys, can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Oh, okay, sorry about that. Max, how you doing? It's Jonathan from Blockpoint.
How's it going?
Good, man. I joined just because I saw you were speaking. Are you still in Boston or are you back?
Yeah, I'm in Cambridge, just finishing up. I got, you know, a couple more weeks of MIT problem sets, and then I'm free. So
very cool. Very cool. Doing your GigaBrain thing over there. Just a few questions on more from a macro perspective, right? So obviously the LFG reserve kind of changed a paradigm. What did it do for you guys in terms of what you were building out? You're kind of presenting it on the DPEG that you guys are the last line of defense, whereas the Bitcoin reserve would come into play before the insurance layer, is what I'm understanding. And then on that as well, how did you guys kind of, obviously you can't give me the secret sauce, but how are you guys looking at Luna itself? Obviously the burn is not going to be as great as it was, given that a bunch of these, you know, emissions are going towards the Bitcoin buy for the LFG. How does that look for AVAX and some of these other tokens that are going to be, you know, coming into the ecosystem? So is it like a certain proportion is going towards the Bitcoin and then a much smaller proportion towards AVAX as these rewards come in? And along with that, how did you actually program that into your algorithms in order to stabilize the peg? And if that's too vague, I can get a little more specific, but that's kind of the macro question I have is what is the flow here of what's going on in order to hold that peg?
Yeah, so are we talking about the Bitcoin reserve fund here?
In general, the flow of, let's say we already have a situation where there was a proposal passed, right, for the APR, APY to go down on Anchor. And as we all know, Anchor is the, you know, number one dApp in the ecosystem, highest, highest LTV, right, in the space for Terra Luna. So let's say the demand for that starts to go down as the APR goes down. Hypothetically, let's say the, you know, as we're expecting, the borrows don't increase that much and the APR goes down, and we do see a decrease in demand for UST just because of a decrease in demand for Anchor, and the rest of the ecosystem hasn't caught up, let's say. You know, gaming and some of these other dApps haven't yet caught up. What are the lines of defense? Like, what is the order that takes place in terms of protecting the peg as that occurs, as, let's say, UST starts to flee the system?
Yeah, so I guess there's been a lot of kind of stuff on this recently on the forums, and I've been following it pretty closely. So the first line of defense for the peg is actually deep liquidity on Curve and other kind of stablecoin pools on Astroport and on the centralized exchanges and on Curve on mainnet and on Avalanche. So there's actually deep liquidity for UST to USDC, USDT, Frax on Curve mainnet, thanks to the Curve wars being over, you know, so that's kind of the first line of defenses. First, all that liquidity has to either be removed from the Curve pool or, you know, traded one direction.
JD, you have some feedback on your mic. If you could mute yourself while he's talking.
Yeah. So
apologies.
So then the second line of defense is the Luna mint burn arbitrage, which says if your UST is kind of worth less than a dollar according to some oracle, then you can get an amount of Luna which is worth more than that according to a different oracle. So that's the main primary peg mechanism for Terra Luna, right? And then the third line of defense is the Bitcoin Reserve Fund, which kicks in around 0.97, and then the fourth line of defense would be if you had purchased protection through Risk Harbor. Once we are offering UST peg protection, you could redeem it through there. But yeah, there's a lot of things that have to go really wrong, which are very unlikely for anything to happen. Even if, as you say, like demand starts to dwindle or there's a rough period or bear market. I think one of the things is like this is a network effects game, you know. And if Terra, which has been doing very well, is able to establish itself as a dominant place where people want to build and capital wants to flow, and there's a lot of apps and all kinds of stuff like that, I mean, then it's going to win regardless of whether the APR and Anchor is, you know, 16% or 18% or 19.5%. Like, it's right now the stage of the game is how fast can Terra grow, how fast can Anchor grow and bring capital into the ecosystem and bring developers and bring a community together, and if that stage is successful, then it's going to be really, really good for UST and Luna.
Yep. Totally get it. Just wanted to understand the order of the protections. And then last piece is, how do you see Prism and Kinetic Money fitting into this, in that they create deeper liquidity pools and allow people to build longer tail, you know, yield strategies and essentially bond strategies around Terra Luna long term? Do you see that as kind of protecting the peg and the ecosystem as well, longer term?
Yeah, so I think ultimately, I think Prism has only launched their BLUNA right now, not anything directly with Anchor. But the idea being that you kind of lock your capital in to you know, some staking, and you can start to create financial derivatives, fixed income off of that. And I think that's really attractive for traditional market investors, for big institutions, and even for kind of retail investors who are looking towards retirement soon. So those are like important things to bring more capital in. And they also have the effect of saying that capital must be locked in the anchor pool or whatever, in the BLUNA or whatever, for the period of time on the fixed income products. So those are great things and exciting things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, generally derivative markets help to, I mean, in theory, lower that volatility just because you bring in that much more liquidity and you allow people to kind of bet on both sides of the equation. Right. So that's what I'm saying. I think people are underrating what Prism can do for the ecosystem long term, at least right now, just because there's not a lot of liquidity and it's still relatively new. But I think the long tail effect there is it's going to help to stabilize Luna and be really like a great support for UST. And not shilling at all, I'm not involved with Prism, but just looking at it from a traditional finance perspective, I think there's a lot of value there.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Hey, Max, so we're coming up. Along the same line of questioning, so if there's a sudden sort of increase in remittances of UST, have you guys been looking at what the demand is from the perspective of the central exchanges like your Binances or Coinbases in terms of their appetite for acquiring more UST for their liquidity and reserves, like the professional market makers that are involved with all of that? Because it would seem to me that, you know, so let's say I go and take a bunch of UST and, you know, dump it at Coinbase. Like, I don't think organizations that large have a immediate need to be, you know, worried about their reserves of those coins. So does that make sense? Like, as a sponge to absorb UST, do you think that there's a lot of room there with the centralized exchanges still to absorb that?
I think what the centralized exchanges specialize in is really tight spreads. So if you're moving a lot of volume, you're going to want to go over the counter or through like the curve pool. But what I think the place that the centralized exchanges are really specializing in is like just really tightening the spread. And also because they're kind of centralized, as was mentioned earlier, they can more easily offer certain types of centrally cleared derivatives like futures and options. And that's just because they're kind of a trusted counterparty that can set up the mechanisms that are needed for a clearinghouse. So I think that's the role of the centralized exchanges, in my view. I don't know, like, I don't think that those are going to be sources of deep liquidity, because if something starts to go wrong, then the market makers are going to, you know, pack up. And so there isn't going to be much liquidity there. So that's why there's going to be a lot of speculation of something if there's kind of a potential DPEG looking like it might happen. But ultimately, I think, yeah, the centralized exchanges are kind of good at making very tight spreads and derivatives and not as great at offering deep liquidity that stabilizes in the event of a peg, because the liquidity providers are very nimble. So,
great question, Seffy. Let's take these last two questions, if you guys are okay with it, since we're here at the hour mark. So we have Morpheus and then yours truly. So Morpheus, if you want to ask a question, go ahead.
Sure. Thanks for letting me speak. I just wanted to sort of understand if there was a strategy overall around diversifying the concentration of UST on Anchor, because obviously, you know, significant amount of market cap is held, a significant market cap of UST is held in Anchor. So I would just sort of, I understand there's a number of things that are sort of, you know, emerging, the four curve pool, you know, individual users pairing on CEXs. And I understand that will happen over time, but I'm sort of thinking, as I look at the growth in UST market cap and the component of that that is being allocated to Anchor continues to remain significantly high. And obviously over a period of time, this should then transition into various different uses of UST. But I'm sort of thinking, how could we make it smooth such that the transition from concentration to Anchor protocol is sort of spread out across different ecosystems? There's a number of things at play, and I'm sort of assuming that all the Anchor sort of deposits are sort of your standard standard deposits and not sort of degen type plays. As you start sort of going into other parts, other protocols of Terra, it's not a stable coin yield, so it does become a bit of a risk appetite thing. You know, if someone's willing to sort of, you know, understand what Astro does, what Prism does, things like that, there's a steep learning curve as a result of that. Sorry, I'm rambling, but the point I'm trying to make is, how do we get from a concentrated position of UST into a more diversified position?
I kind of think you answered your own question there at the beginning. That's exactly what's happening. It's like, yeah, getting more trading pairs on different DEXs, and even some centralized exchanges are looking to start to move towards offering more pairs in UST. So those are really the ways to get some true organic use cases for UST, continue to expand that. And I think over time, we'll see a greater balance there.
Yeah, but does that require sort of an individual to be a bit of a degen and a bit of a, for example, for four curve pool, for example, a Terra or an Anchor deposit maker would have to be interacting with different ecosystems and, you know, learning all that, all those aspects and what does that mean and things like that, versus just purely Anchor, click deposit, earn the yield. So there's a level of a learning curve for someone who is on Anchor versus who is trying to go in a four curve pool, for example, or even, you know, even a stable coin pair somewhere to get a similar yield, stable coin pool, for example, because as soon as you start getting to LPs and yield farming, you're starting to sort of, you know, get a little bit degen. Is that you need to know, you need to understand what you're doing from that regard, versus Anchor protocol, stable coin, click two buttons, you earn 20% yield. So it's a lot more simple versus the steps to diversify UST use, an individual needs to be a lot more, there needs to be a lot more learning curve involved in that, is sort of where I'm sort of getting at. And it makes it a little bit more of a slower transition over time and not as immediate as sort of I personally would love. But it's sort of a catch 22, I suppose. You know, we want the growth in the ecosystem, but at the same time, we want it to diversify as well. But
it's a fair point. Yeah, that's definitely a struggle, but I think we'll get there as UST gets more well known. We're going to see more centralized exchanges probably adopting pairs of UST that have organic use cases there. So I think we'll get there.
And I mean, this is one of the things that we see Risk Harbor taking a role in, at least for the institutionals, is to say, come to our website, come talk with our people, and we'll tell you about the opportunities on Anchor, but we are also going to be offering through our V2, you know, opportunities on other protocols. And so purchasing protection through Risk Harbor on Anchor can be a gateway to the other protocols in the ecosystem as they see that there are other safe strategies that they can employ throughout the ecosystem with other protocols. That's part of the vision for Risk Harbor, isn't
it? That's fantastic. Awesome.
Guys,
let's great question, Morpheus. Let's take this last question since we're already 6 minutes over, and then we'll wrap this thing up. I think this has been a fantastic conversation. Yours truly, do you want to ask a question?
Your mic is off.
I was noticing that we're having people disconnecting. It looks like typical Twitter AMA bugs. So maybe we'll just leave it there since we're over. I think we're a bit over. People might have things, other commitments. So thanks everyone for coming out. This was a really great AMA. I know it got technical at times, but I hope we were able to slow it down at other times for you. Really loved the conversation. And everyone have a great rest of your morning or evening, wherever you are. And we'll see you again next week for the Dynamic Anchor AMA.
Yeah, thanks, Max and Jay, for both coming on. This is great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was the Anchor AMA with Risk Harbor, recorded on Thursday, April 21st, 2022. This episode of The Ether was brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening. When I'm ripping and rapping, I ain't picking the bastards who be tricking the masses into getting their asses kicked. Feels like I've been getting my masters. Fuck a pump and double like the income that's passive. Raise up the bar before I fly right past it. I'll be writing rhymes till they put me in a casket. Old man shit, put the lotion on its skin. Then put that shit back in the damn basket like Buffalo Bill, the way I'm ruffling feathers. Snuffing out debt, cut the heads off collectors. Keep a couple heads in a jar as keepsakes, and take the rest and turn them into free bait. Upgrade the feeling, supply the free base. Looking all professional, tools in the briefcase. Running on empty from gassing up my teammates. First one down, let me know how that sleep tastes.
Now places the lotion in the basket.
And impossible, defending the plausible from end to demonstrable. The mission isn't even worried about the clearance. Running interference till our enemies fear us. We're only one disappearance away from a bad day. Everybody trying to save face on the last day. Feeling fancy, about to pull out the masse. Drop the eight ball in passing, that's so passe. I'm getting nasty, you cannot put it past me. A mix between blasphemy and talk everlasting. Feeling like a masterpiece, looking like a tragedy. Trying to get through another day full of savagery. Getting headstrong from working in the mess hall, all hands on deck, waiting for our next haul. I need the rest, got big plans to eject, so feed the grass and keep off the Kleenex.
I am interested in magic because I am fascinated with psychology. I love to learn about how people make inferences done, how they draw conclusions and find patterns and information. And in particular, I'm interested in all that can go wrong. How an individual can be led astray by certain cognitive vulnerabilities or exploited.
Terra Spaces.